I think I'm having an art attack.
Welcome to another episode of Art Attack. We are here with your host, Lizzie Dastin, and myself, Justin Bua. Lizzie is a PhD art historian, professor, lecturer at Christie's and all kinds of places around the world, and a wonderful, amazing teacher, and a very well-spoken human being. I mean, there's very little people who are as well-spoken as Lizzie Dastin. And myself, Justin Bua, just a schmuck, just a guy who's just a freaking schmuck who, on his Instagram post, he talks a lot of shit and, you know, gets a lot of shit for it. But I'm trying to keep it real, and I'm an artist for the people, by the people, and other people. So today, Lizzie has chosen an artist that I really didn't know anything about. I don't know why he hasn't been on my radar, but, you know, Lizzie chose him from her radar and threw it into the Art Attack mix, and we're going to learn a lot about him. Why don't you tell us about who we're even going to talk about?
So today we're going to talk about Sam Gilliam, and he is a really significant painter and somebody that I wanted to dialogue with you today about, because he made work in a way that defied the expectations of people in his community. Specifically, Gilliam was a Black painter, and he came to prominence in a really critical time for Black people in the Black community in the 60s. And so much work that was being made by Black artists at the time was fiercely political, and its intentionality was to activate people politically, to share that kind of communication that was charged with social and narrative intent. And then here Gilliam is, and he's painting these non-objective canvases. And we'll talk about the significance of those canvases later, but he is not charging his work with any kind of explicitly Black content. And there was always a little bit of a schism between the expectations that the art world might have of him, expectations that perhaps his colleagues might have of him, and then the desires that were intrinsic to Gilliam himself and the expectations that he had for his art making. And I do think that's important, just to situate him within the 60s, because here we have in 65, Malcolm X was assassinated. A few years later in 68, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. We have Black Power and the civil rights movement, and everything is unfolding on the streets of cities like Washington, D.C., where Gilliam is working. And his choices at this time were to make more geometric color field painting. And I think the choice in and of itself is a quite intriguing one. And then he transitions to the work for which he's known today. But his work was never figurative.
I mean, I know that when he was young, he said he drew horses in the dirt, and he was really good at drawing horses. But, and perhaps I didn't dive deep enough into his work, but I haven't seen any, like you said, figurative work or academic work in his portfolio. Perhaps he did go through the academic boot camp to get where he arrived to, but I'm not familiar with it, because everybody shows his later works, or the works that he's most famous for. If you look at abstract artists, and I know we don't necessarily think of, you don't like to use the word abstract, I'm realizing now for the first time. But if you like, you look at, you know, Picasso or Cezanne, you see early academic work. Have you seen any of his earlier work? Like, because he does talk about it, and he talks about, well, you know, his favorite artists are artists like Tintoretto. I mean, I was surprised at that, because Tintoretto, you talk about non-figurative, Tintoretto is figurative plus, right? He is extremely figurative. So have you seen any of that or no?
I know that he, especially in his early work, there's an amalgam of influences. And I had read that he was inspired by Tintoretto. I think he was also inspired by cartoons, specifically the cartoon of Batman. And maybe that was a drive for him to explore his own art making. But I think a bigger influence for him was the European modernism that he was taught in school. He did go through the traditional academic channels. He received a BA and I believe an MA in painting. And he was a teacher at many different levels for many different years of his life. So he was an academician as well as being a painter. And when he started studying, this was in the freshly post World War II era, when a lot of key European modernists were fleeing their country of origin for safe haven in the United States. And this whole generation of artists, they received teaching from those European greats. And Gilliam is no exception. He had this one German teacher, his last name is Wilke. And that interaction between Gilliam and this mentor proved a really fruitful one. And it was through this exposure that he started to really invest himself in non-objective imagery, because that's what he was taught. And then he pushed that to another level. And he put his own innovation in the process and the technique. And something that I find just truly inspiring about Gilliam is that in his nearly 7 decades long career, it really can be characterized by this quest for reinvention. And so maybe when you say drawing horses in the sand, that is one iteration of this quest, and it could be the origin. And then he pushes himself. What do I want to say? How do I want to say it? How can I make it? And he did achieve some success in the 60s for these drape paintings. Mm-hmm. And his drape paintings were varying in size, but I think the really immersive and experiential ones are the large scale. And he would dye and soak and stain unprimed canvas that he never stretched. So the canvas was just the cloth. And then instead of stretching that canvas and displaying it in a traditional manner, he basically draped the canvas directly on a wall. And for me, this hybridity between not only painting and sculpture, but also architecture was quite innovative. I have seen one of these drape works at MoMA, and it is completely immersive. And that element of performance, I think he got when he was stationed in the army in Japan. And he discovered the Gutai group, which was this very, at the time, experiential, bodily oriented group of Japanese artists. And there's some connection and cross-pollination there between Jackson Pollock too, which is, you know, my deep love for Pollock. So perhaps that initially is what attracted me to Gilliam. But this is what he's seeing. He's seeing non-objective use of really ebullient color, and he is pushing himself to conceptualize the presentation outside of a traditionally stretched and mounted canvas, as Pollock did, as the Gutai did, but he's taking it a step further by removing the structure of the canvas altogether.
Yeah, I'm a little bit, I guess I feel a little bit like just not understanding of his work, because, you know, if I hear him speak, I like him. He's funny. He's engaging. He's cool. You know, so I like the person. And then when I look at the art, it feels highly avant-garde for you know, especially considering his background and where he's from. And it feels like very almost elitist and non-relatable. Now, I'm trying to be open-minded to abstract art or modern art, contemporary art, performative art, conceptual art. And I find his work to be hard to understand. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about what he was saying, he kind of seems like a funny, ironic guy, is I like abstract art, he says, because it messes with you. He said that. Like, it's almost like I'm fucking with you. You know what I mean? Like, is it just makes me feel like, is he fucking with you? Like, you know, and I look at the work and I can't get into it. Now, that's happened before where I see an artist, I'm not really feeling it. And I'm trying to be open-minded. You know, there's a lot of artists that are in that space, not Jackson Pollock, because I don't like Jackson Pollock, but other artists like, you know, Wayne Thiebaud or Diebenkorn or late Picasso, or there's a lot of modern artists that I think I do love, you know, de Kooning. But I look at his work and I personally can't find anything that draws me in. That's my personal take on it. Okay, now I'm giving a personal take on it, but everyone should look at this on their own and make sure to really, I really implore you to make sure to look up the artist as we're talking about the artist, peruse the internet, look at the images, go to Google, go to images, or go to DuckDuckGo. I don't care what search engine you use, but look at the work. See if you could feel it. And like Lizzie said, you saw the work in person and you really, did you really feel something? Because I've heard you talk about other art where it's made you cry. It's so relatable and you're connecting to it in such a deep, profound way that it's moved you. Does his work move you? Because his work doesn't move anything in me at all.
Interesting. Yeah. And I was really struck by something that you said that I'd love to ask further, but to answer your question, it's true. I do find myself very emotional in front of art, and I am completely just swept away. And I've only cried once, and that was when I saw The Birth of Venus by Botticelli. Oh. And seeing his art, I wouldn't say my emotional response was quite to that level, but I definitely felt subsumed. And so you said that you thought that his art was pretentious, and I would love to ask what about it you find pretentious, because I actually see his art as the complete opposite. So I think it would be interesting for us to talk about that.
I mean, anytime I see something that I can't, that I don't like, which is pretty much most of the things I see at modern contemporary museums. I mean, look, you see my riffs on Instagram. I'm doing stuff I'm talking about stuff. Oftentimes it's completely absurd. The girl who's, you know, striking a giant pile of butter with a cord. The guy who's rubbing his face on this giant, giant, absolutely monolithic pottery wheel, and he's just hammering his face. But, you know, a lot of people love this work. A lot of people get very upset at me for saying, how dare you, shame on you for talking about that work and criticizing it. Everything is art. And you know how I feel as an artist, as somebody who's dedicated blood, sweat, and tears to this world for so many years in the lineage of the masters that come before me, I feel like there's something very important about preserving the preservation and integrity of what art is. Okay. So that doesn't mean that it can't be art to you. I say you as one, right? Of course it can be. Of course, you know, but also to me, I have my opinion. And as you know, some of the posts that I'm getting, you know, whether it's 250,000 plays or 5.2 million plays, people are very heated and they feel very upset when I have an opinion, but it's my opinion. It's my opinion that comes from years of my own personal investigation into the journey of art, as is your opinion of that. Although I really, Lizzie, haven't heard of one artist that you do not like.
That's funny. There are lots of artists that I don't like. We did a whole episode on an artist that we don't like.
Okay. But, maybe perhaps that's true.
Yeah. But so from my perspective, what makes something pretentious is work that feels exclusive, that only some people understand the references. It's only for certain groups, certain elites. And generally that elitism has an associative relationship with academia and schooling. So for me, his art is so much about the experience that you have when you view it, that it's almost anti-elite because everybody gets to have an experience in a space, in your body, with your thoughts. What do you value? And so he universalizes what it's like to view art because we don't need to have taken his class or listen to him lecture. We can just be. And there's something really beautiful to me about his site specificity and even a site responsiveness. When the drape paintings, they encourage you to walk around. They emphasize rotation in a way that I don't think traditional painting does. And even his work that is stretched on canvas and mounted on a wall, that shows process innovation. He used something called these beveled edges, where he would construct at a 45 degree angle these supports for his work. And so the canvas would jut out toward the viewer. And he mentioned that at the time that he was thinking about this, the world is in the space race. And so he, as an artist, was really thinking about space. And is space linear? And he decided for himself that space is prismatic. And so these beveled canvases were a way to honor that discovery in his own work. So what I find so unpretentious is just that we don't even need to know that. We don't need to know about any connection between Gilliam and his blackness necessarily, or Gilliam and the context of the 60s and the political landscape of the space race. We can just walk into a room and decide, huh, how do I feel about that painting invading my space in a way that I'm not accustomed to? And I always find that interaction with the viewer and that activation of us as something really profound that art can do. And so to me, it's not static. It's very dialogical. And that's how I felt when I was in that room. And I'm not going to say it's the same kind of response that I had when I saw The Birth of Venus, but it doesn't make it any less wonderful. It's really it forced me to ask myself more questions than I'm used to doing.
You know, the thing is, for me, what really discerns, and this is a greater discussion and perhaps a little esoteric, but what it makes me think is, you know, some art, obviously, very, very few can do. Very, very few people can do a Jerome painting. You know, maybe nobody, you know what I mean? Like, as where other things, many people can do. And so to me, there's criteria to determine what art is. And it doesn't make it, like I said, not art in anybody's eyes, but in my eyes and others, I feel like there are certain things. And I feel like when I see his work, people can do that. And perhaps there's something that I don't know. I know that there's a lot of process. And I think that modern contemporary artists or non-objective artists, is that what the word is now?
The new buzzword
for non-abstract is non-objective
artists. Between you
artists.
And me, it's the buzzword.
Between me and you. So I think that non-objective artists, you know, there's a lot of people that can do that. And they're really into process, right? Everything is process. Like when I heard him talk about his process, it's like there's four layers and, you know, you coat this and you use a spray gun for that. And I get that. It seems to be that there's more of a concern for the process, more of a concern for the fact that the artist has created that in a bubble, that the artist has created that alone, that the artist has created that with no outside influence. I've hear that all the time with contemporary artists, which is bizarre. It's like a weird buzzword where everyone's been alone and nothing. I'm not saying he has, but I've noticed that there are some similarities. There's a thread where every contemporary artist seems to say that as if there's no influence whatsoever from the outside world. Now, obviously he didn't say that at all because he was influenced, like you said, by Batman. He said also Black Panther. And then when Wonder Woman came along, boom, you know, he was more influenced by Wonder Woman. He's really actually really funny, but I look at his work and I'm not moved by it. And I'm hearing everything you're saying. And you're speaking about him as you always do about all the artists that you speak about, not whether you love them or hate them, with such wonder. You have a wonder almost about it. And I look at his work and I could say, okay, what do I like about it? Like if anyone could tune in right now and they could say, what do I like about it? What can I relate? Because you can't argue if somebody just likes it. People, you know, people tell me all the time, oh, I love this Rothko. Why? I don't know. There's something about it. It just moves me. It's, or, you know, you get the person, like some of my friends who go, I love Rothko. Why? It goes well on my couch. It goes great with the walls.
Oh, no,
no, it's true. I mean, it's the artist's nightmare, but that's very true. And that's why people do that, because art is also decorative. Yeah. And I look at his work and I see a hanging rag. Sometimes it looks dirty. Sometimes it looks colorful. It's obviously canvas, it's linen, right? And I don't see something that anybody else can't do. Call me ignorant, call me naive, call me a purist, call me somebody who is an old, kvetchy, angry Puerto Rican Jew. I don't know, but I really, from any level. And what has helped me, and maybe it helps some of our listeners out there in the past, is when I have excavated their history and I go, oh, wow, well, he did, you know, Cézanne did all this academic figure drawing at the Sorbonne, and he then did all these academic landscapes. And then he went from here to here and here, and you could see the chronology of it and his development of draftsmanship, and then releasing it and letting it go into this abstract contemporary world of cubism and abstraction or non-objective art. Then he's like, then I could see it, and it contextualizes his journey for me. I don't believe that you need to necessarily do that, but for me, That's what does help me understand an artist. Like I'm looking at the painting behind you, right? And what's her name? Colette Miller?
Miller, yeah.
Yeah, Colette Miller, who does the wings. And it looks like maybe his work. It looks like his work that's been folded open. Now, I'm not saying I don't like her work at all, because I know I'm only looking at the bottom half of the painting, right? So I'm seeing an abstract corner of her painting, but it reminds me of his work, ironically, that I feel like I'm looking at his work right now a way, because what I see is these crazy colors and abstract shapes. And I'm not, I'm not understanding it. And I just feel like oftentimes the art world wants to fill a void beyond they want to fill a void of a, you know, somebody like Jean-Michel Basquiat. He was at the right place at the right time to me. Basquiat for me, you know, and I come from New York, I come from the streets. I grew up with guys like Zephyr and Futura and Doze and Bill Blast and all the old school graffiti writers, Tracy 168 and all the B-boys. And this is a theme that we know that's not necessarily a mainstream theme or theory, but we know that Basquiat in many ways was a proxy for Leo Castelli and Andy Warhol because they needed a black artist. But did they use Dondi? No. Why would they use Dondi? He's too street. Did they use any of the brothers from my neighborhood? No, too street. He was articulate. He was good looking. He was charming. He was Haitian. He was a little street, but he was also refined and he was able to be malleable. To me, in my opinion, Basquiat, and I'm not saying Basquiat was a good or bad artist. I don't want to comment on that. But I think he was used by white America to broaden their appeal, the gallery's appeal to the mass. And I wonder, do you think Sam is maybe in some capacity, I'm not saying because a lot of people love him, but in some capacity, was he being, you know, was his artwork being utilized in that, in a similar way?
To ameliorate whiteness? I don't personally think so, but I think the question is an important one. And I think that gets back to the schism that there was between how he chose to make art and how some people expected that he would choose to make art. And specifically, that would be really leaning into his experience as a black man, a black body, which he never did. I think the closest he came, he titled some of his paintings April. Maybe he repeated April, April, and that was in 1968. And that was the month and the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated. So
yep. April 4th.
There was, right. So there was a symbolic reference to something that was traumatic for many, many people, but had a different kind of resonance for people in the black community. But no, I think that he always identified just as an artist alone. And I think that is controversial. I'm relaying that to something that I can speak to a little bit better when people who are women will say, no, I'm not a feminist artist. I'm not a woman artist. I'm just an artist who happens to be a woman. And I see that line of questioning, conceptualizing yourself as potentially problematic, because why couldn't he embrace his experiences in a way that would identify his blackness? But why should he have to? If the way that he wanted to paint was non-objective because of how he was taught and how he was inspired by nature and space and architecture, why do we expect anything other than what he was able to provide? So I think that answering your question is pretty complicated, but I personally do not think that he was just shoehorned into prominence because of his blackness. I think that actually, because of that, since the art world is historically and in a way that is not so secretive, it is very, very championing of whiteness, yes, that his career didn't take off in the way that it might have because of his racialized identity. And just to counteract what I just said or to add nuance to it, he was the first Black artist to represent the United States at the Venice Biennale in 72. And then some 40-ish years later, he once again represented the United States at the Biennale in, I think it was 2017. So yeah. I think there's always this interesting dialogue between his race and his art and the art world's perception of his race and his art. Yeah. And I understand your point completely, but personally, I don't think that he was used as a conduit.
Yeah, it's not my point. It was my question. You know, I wasn't making a point. I was really questioning. It's like, you know, I don't think that, you know, you look at Ernie Barnes, you look at Kehinde Wiley, you look at Thomas Blackshear, you look at Romare Bearden. Those are some of the most powerful artists in the world. They're all Black. You know what I'm saying? And like, I don't love Doze Green because he's Puerto Rican. I love Doze Green because I love Doze Green because he's freaking dope. You know what I mean? Like I want people to love art because, you know, because they're not a proxy and they're not, you know, a Dominican dude or a Puerto Rican dude or a Black dude or a woman or, you know, feminist. I want them, like, we agree that you should love an artist because they're great, you know, and it was really a question that I had for you because I don't really know too much about the history and what galleries he exhibited at and what museums he exhibited at. And, you know, as I get older, I find my mind to be more open to non-objective art and conceptual art, but I still have to, you know, be honest and realistic about, you know, my personal feelings. And I'm always going to contextualize that. Remember, I did my book on the legends of hip hop, where I painted 50 of the greatest legends of hip hop. And I say in the beginning of the book that these are my people, you know, these are my choices. This is a personal, pointed discovery about my heroes that led me into the culture of hip hop. And people still got pissed. Either they didn't read the intro of the book, but they were like, hey, you never included, you know, De La Soul. And why didn't you include, you know? And I'm like, dude, I wrote, this is my opinion. This is my objective. I'm seeing this world through Justin Bua's eyes, not anyone else's. So yeah, that's a question that I always ask, you know, and I think that's an important one. And, you know, I will take a deeper, you know, look at his work as I will other artists that we've talked about on this podcast. And I don't want to like artists just because, you know, they're Puerto Rican or they're, you know, they're whatever, you know, they were an ex B-boy and now he's, I got to love this guy. No, I don't want to do that. I want to love them because I love the work. I feel connected to the work. And I want everybody on every podcast we do to really look into the work and also their history of the work that they do to see where it comes from, because that's really important to do. And to challenge also, just because everyone out there is saying it or doing it, just because they're doing it, don't be a sheep. Discover it yourself and have an opinion of your own. People get really pissed off when I have an opinion because they don't feel like anybody should have an opinion. We live in the day and an age where everyone has become soft. They're like butter. Everything is nerf-edged. And it's disgusting. Because we have to each have a real opinion. We can't just listen to the masses and be like, yeah, I like them. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. Because if I don't, I'm going to get shunned. I'm going to get shamed. I'm so weak. Stop it, please. Just have an opinion. And really come from a place of, you know, authenticity with it. And I think the art world, like many other worlds, forces you into an opinion. Just because that's hanging on the wall of the Met or the MoMA or the Musée d'Orsay or the Prada, it doesn't matter. It might not be art to you. You might be like, why is this here? That's okay. Or, oh my God, I could see why this is here. Wow, this is, oof, I'm getting chills. You know what I mean? I feel like you, I've been moved by many paintings like you. The way that you cried with Botticelli, I've been floored as a painter where I've thought, oh my God, it's either stopped my heart where I said, I'll never paint again, or this is inspiring me to just rush back to my studio to paint more. And people should feel that. And if you don't feel anything, that's okay. That's fine.
Well, I think that good art makes you feel something. And even though you and I seem to feel different things when we look at Gilliam's work, we do have feelings. They have provoked this really rich and divergent conversation. So
that's right.
I think, yeah. So it's, we don't have to feel the same thing for it to have meaning.
Yeah. Look, it's about discovery and investigation and then coming up with an unfiltered opinion. And, you know, look, I might in 5 years come back to you and be like, dude, I can't believe this, but Gilliam's the greatest artist I've ever seen in my life. I was crazy. I was crazy when I said I didn't like his work. Right. And that happens, by the way, all the time. Or I go through phases. Oh my God, I love this. This is incredible. And I'm like, not really incredible anymore. So keep an open mind, keep an open heart. We love everybody. Share this podcast because this is the real deal. And you're not going to get anybody as knowledgeable as Lizzie.
Or you. And please subscribe. And we'll see you next week. And thank you so much for listening.
Yes. Peace.